Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We begin every show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman when he testified in 2019 before the impeachment hearings. I also want to remind you that I want the words of Vindman ringing in your ears as you go into the election booth, or you get an absentee ballot, or you vote by mail, or however you exercise the franchise. But I also posted something on my personal Facebook page, and it was a story coming out of Wisconsin, because I want you to remember Wisconsin too. And this story came out from yesterday, and it talks about the number of deaths and increases in COVID contamination from that election, because Al and I have had time to really process all that information. Wait till you see the graph. It is shocking. If there's a reason to expand absentee balloting and voting by mail, remember Wisconsin. Now, the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Joining me as he does every Friday, Scott Braddock, the voice of Texas, the editor of the Quorum Report, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. As I told him when he just came on the air a few minutes ago, I said my two favorite Texans. You and Glenn Smith are like bookends.
Oh, here we go.
I want to move to Texas.
You wouldn't know anything about Glenn Smith if it wasn't for Scott Braddock.
No.
Let's be honest.
Well, you were so funny.
And you know what? And you wouldn't know, and I know who your actual favorite Texan is. You wouldn't know anything about Scott Braddock without Rick Perry.
That's absolutely true. But before Rick Perry, I would know even less about Texas if I hadn't had dinner with Ann Richards in Austin. Did you know that? I had
dinner. Well, then that's your favorite Texan.
Well, she.
Rest in peace. God.
I tell you, I love her when she was wearing the white leather, driving the Harley or whatever she was driving. Oh, my God. She was in her hair swept up. Someday when I grow really sort of old and white, I'm going to have that French knot and I'm going to get myself a Harley. Anyway.
You're not the first little girl to wish and hope that she was Ann Richards when she grew up.
Oh, God. Me, absolutely. All right. So let's start with the Texas Supreme Court. Because as I mentioned Wisconsin, and I mentioned the tragedy of Wisconsin, which was they had to vote in person, and the number of people who contracted COVID, the number of people who have died, and now we really have real numbers because it takes time to evaluate this. Tell me what the Texas Supreme Court did vis-a-vis COVID-19 is perhaps could be perceived as a disability or not.
Whether it could be perceived as a disability, under Texas law, you can receive a mail-in ballot. You can request one, an absentee ballot, if you have a physical condition that prevents you from voting if you have a disability. And the argument has been from the Democrats and from voting rights advocates that if you lack immunity to this disease that is ravaging the planet, that is a physical condition, and that means that you should be able to get a mail-in ballot. And the state disagreed with that, looking at the state statute that governs who can get a mail-in ballot. The attorney general's office has argued that, no, you can't say that because you lack immunity that you have a disability. You have seen this framed in the media and framed by Republican leadership as fear of COVID-19, that the Democrats are somehow arguing that because people are afraid they might catch coronavirus, that they shouldn't have to go vote in person. And Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick on Fox News Channel just about a week ago, just after I talked to you, Arnie, he said that it was all a scam by the Democrats. And he kept pointing to CDC information. And I want you pay attention to exactly what he's pointing to. Okay. Because to me, it seems very cynical. I wonder what you think. The lieutenant governor points to the fact that the CDC data shows that those who are over 65, and particularly those who are over 80, are the most vulnerable to die from coronavirus if they catch it. And he doesn't say that that people may get sick, horribly sick, that people may go through some excruciating pain if they get this disease. Apparently it's terrible, even if, you know, in a lot of cases, even if people recover from it. The bar probably shouldn't have to be that you're concerned about dying to go exercise the franchise of voting. I would think, and you might think, and we'll see what the federal courts say. There's a state level case that was settled up by the Supreme Court, the Texas Supreme Court, just yesterday, as we're taping here on Thursday. And the state Supreme Court sided with the state and said that no, that the lack of immunity to COVID-19 does not qualify you for a ballot. But you might think that, you know, we'll see how this goes to the rest of the court case in the federal courts. And they're making some voting rights arguments in the federal courts, Arnie. About this, and see where we shake out. But a couple of things. One, I don't think it should be such a high bar that we're concerned about whether people get killed if they go to vote. That's number one. And number two, there is so much confusion. We're sort of bouncing between the guardrails in this deal, where you would have one court say one thing, that people can get mail-in ballots. Then you would have another court say no. Then another court says yes. Another court says no. And people are seeing all this go by, and they wonder, what in the world am I really supposed to do? How am I supposed to handle it if I've been locked down at my house for months now? And I see that the leadership is starting to tell me that, oh, it's okay to go out now, start going back to businesses, start going to restaurants, start going to maybe to sporting events at some point, and go to the gym and all of that. But what if I don't want to do that? I mean, right now, Governor Abbott here in Texas has opened up various businesses, and he said that they can operate at 25 or 50% capacity. People can go to retail stores, they can go to restaurants, but around Austin, a lot of people are not doing that. A lot of people are still just staying at home. The governor says you don't have to wear a mask. He says that he encourages it, but that you're not required to wear a mask. You remember there was some push and pull between the local governments and the state government about whether masks ought to be required. Right now, they're not required in Texas, but you still see a lot of people, you know, they have the mask on if they do go out in public. Meantime, the Texas Secretary of State, the vote counting lady, put out a guidance this week telling us this, Arnie, actual guidance from the state of Texas. And I had a Republican call me and say, why don't the Democrats just take this guidance from the Secretary of State and copy paste it as a legal brief in their, you know, in their fight to try to get mail-in ballots? Because what the Secretary of State is advising sounds like a Saturday Night Live skit. Like you have to go vote in person if you're not 65 in Texas, according to everything that has played out so far. So the Secretary of State said you should think about bringing your own hand sanitizer. You should consider wearing a mask. You should, if you show up with COVID-19 symptoms on election day, this is unbelievable. And the headlines, by the way, Arnie, focused on the hand sanitizer and the masks. But deep down in the guidance from the Secretary of State, it says, if you show up on election day at the polling place and you have COVID-19 symptoms, you should consider curbside voting, voting out on the street. We do it in Texas. It's kind of a cumbersome deal. And this is for folks who, in some cases, might have some disability, but they still want to vote in person. So you might have a little elderly lady who, you know, can't make it all the way into the polling place. So they would bring all the stuff out to her, and they have to have a witness for her to be able to vote. And
are they going to have the
all of that?
To cover everyone?
Are they going to have the PPE? Are they going to protect people? It does not appear to be.
I have an idea.
And so, Arnie, you look at all this and you think there is going to be a lot of confusion. And I want to repeat something that I believe I mentioned on the show last week. What are we really doing here? There are 254 counties in Texas. There are that many elections administrators in Texas. Are they all going to deny the 60-year-old person? Listen, if you're over 65, you can get the mail-in ballot today. No question. The lieutenant governor had said that means that we're protecting those folks who are most at risk of death.
Death, dying.
But let's say in Odessa, pretty conservative area, Permian Basin, you know, one of the big shale plays out there, you know, oil coming out of the ground, although it's not worth very much right now, but very conservative part of the state, 60-year-old woman requests a mail-in ballot. And the reason is that she thinks she might get COVID-19 if she goes down to the polling place. I don't know that the elections administrator in Odessa out there in that county is going to say no. They may just go on and send that woman the mail-in ballot. Who's going to question it? Who's going to check it? At the state level, from the state Supreme Court, after their ruling, from the Attorney General, who's going to police this, that they have said that woman can't have a mail-in ballot? It's not going to happen. So here's what's really happening, Arnie, and here's what I think may go on here, sort of a shell game. The Republican Party, and I'm going to talk more about this in a minute, but the Republican Party is very concerned about losing some races here in Texas this year. Going to be a very competitive year. Is President Trump going to win in Texas? I'd say probably. Is he going to win by a smaller margin than he did in 2016? I'd say probably. Now, no predictions, as you know. But if Democrats punch through at the statewide level, let's say Democrats win a seat on the state Supreme Court. Let's say that Democrats, if you think about an election night, Arnie, you get the little alerts from the Associated Press or from NBC News or whatever. When the alert comes across, it'll be a national headline, I would think, if it says the Associated Press projects that the Democratic Party will control the Texas House of Representatives for the first time since 2001, people might notice that. Now, look around the chessboard, look around the map. How are they going to win those races? I'm looking at the numbers right now, Arnie. Those are going to be tight races. You might have a Democrat win by 8 votes in Dallas County. You might have a Democrat win by 20 votes down in Harris County where Houston is. You might have a Democrat win a seat by 200 votes. Do you think that it's possible that after all of this back and forth about mail-in ballots, if the minority party is able to pick up the majority in the Texas House or they win one of these statewide races, let's say John Cornyn loses his race, the United States Senate race, and he loses just by a handful of votes. You think there aren't going to be election challenges? You think that the state's not going to run in or those campaigns won't run in and say, you know, lawyer up, send lawyers guns and money, figure out we're going to settle all this up. And they're going to argue that there were mail-in ballots that went to people that never should have gone to them. And because of all this confusion, we also have a provisional ballot process, as I'm sure you maybe do there in New Hampshire, where, you know, let's say you don't have the right address on your ID, because we have a strict voter ID law in Texas. You're able to sign an affidavit at the polling location that says, this is where I live, I'm eligible to vote here, and I'm casting a provisional ballot. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, because of all this various confusion, I can imagine some people would be siphoned off into sending a lot of these provisional ballots and voting that way. And a lot of those just may never get counted. So there's a lot of room for shenanigans because of all the confusion.
Okay, so I have a couple of thoughts. And that is, so I hear what the Supreme Court said, and they basically said you cannot, fear of contracting COVID is not considered a disability for the purposes of getting an absentee ballot. I capisce. Now, you mentioned that Dan Patrick talked about the number of dead, and that this really was only about people that were old. So I was just listening to MSNBC. I just want everyone to know it's Thursday morning. We tape for tomorrow on Friday. So I'm listening to Thursday morning MSNBC, and I'm listening to a doctor who actually said something I have been thinking a lot about. This is a story he told, but it relates to COVID. When we sent young men and women over to Afghanistan, the great success of what happened was that people that would have historically died in the field were now able to be saved and put into some kind of a helicopter or a plane, shipped off to Germany, and they survived what historically would have been absolute death on the war front. He said, that sounds like a good story. He said, but let me tell you about that good story. So what does that mean? It means we have thousands and thousands of incredibly disabled veterans that historically we would not have been able to save. But now they came home, missing appendages, having brain damage, not being able to walk. We save these people, but understand that our commitment to them now is for the next 50 years, which is not a bad thing, but this is the consequence of what we say. With COVID-19, what we have discovered is you can contract the illness, you cannot die from the illness, but you might have permanent lung damage, you might have permanent kidney damage, you might have permanent heart damage. So the fact that they're only pointing to death doesn't tell you the consequence of COVID-19. It is not like a flu in any way, shape, or form. And the kind of long-term damage is incalculable. And that's the part that I think that if I were arguing for the Supreme Court, it's not just the fear of dying. It's the fear that my family has to now take care of me, and I now become a burden on society because I contracted a disease and survived, but survived so damaged. And that's a new wrinkle that we didn't know about 2 months ago.
I think that a lot of people are going to go ahead and request mail-in ballots, and they will probably get them. I would add this, Arnie. The state law says that you are eligible for a mail-in ballot if you're going to be out of Texas at the time of the election. If you're not going to be here for early voting, if you're not going to be here for Election Day, you can leave. And I was talking with an elections expert yesterday, who leans Republican, by the way, who said that there's really no verification process for that. If you request the mail-in ballot and you say you're not going to be in Texas, nobody follows up and says, you know, can I see your itinerary for your travel schedule? Can I see your plane tickets or any of that? No one did. And there's no apparatus for that. There's nobody checking all of that. So I think there's going to be a lot of people who go ahead and do it, and we're going to see how all this is going to shake out. But I do think that the way that this is being fought by the Republicans in Texas is an outlier. I don't see this in other states. I've seen where, and I'm sure that there has been some, but it seems like the Attorney General here, Ken Paxton, the governor and the lieutenant governor have really lined up behind President Trump because he has said no mail-in ballots. You know, that's what is going to lead to all this fraud all across the country. And let's keep in mind, President Trump, he's the guy who complains about fraud in an election that he won.
I know.
Remember, he kept saying the reason he lost the popular vote was because there were so many quote unquote illegal votes in California, which there was no evidence for. It's the problem of the sore winner.
Yeah, the sore
winner.
Got to
get past that. Got to get past that.
Right. And again, I want to remind everyone that, you know, we are in New Hampshire, and our Republican governor, Chris Sununu, has now determined, I mean, this is his decision, that fear of contracting COVID is a disability for the purposes of getting a absentee ballot. So I just want everyone to know you've got two Republican governors, both of whom are somewhat lackeys of Donald Trump, but one Republican governor is surrounded by a Republican legislature and therefore has this moat of GOP around him. My Republican governor is surrounded by Democrats, and he is up for re-election, and he is terrified because virtually every single elected official in New Hampshire, except for him, is a Democrat. So fascinating. Suddenly, his interpretation of fear of COVID is considered, quote unquote, a disability. But in GOP Texas, you have an opposite, you know, decision. And I think, frankly, this is where the Supreme Court has to come in and make some kind of a decision. How can it be a disability in one state and not be perceived as a disability in another? To me, there's something wrong here. And now you've got a case of two Republican governors coming out with the exact opposite conclusions. This is party specific and outcome different.
Well, when the president tries to put pressure on the different governors and the elections administrators around the country and the way they're going to do this, remember, we have a decentralized system for the way our elections work, which is a good thing. You know, we don't have a quote unquote national election. We have 50 state elections. And even beneath that, we have the counties that run these elections at the local level. And so it's almost not possible for the president to really assert that the elections have to be run a certain way. He can't even keep all the Republicans in line, like you say. And here in Texas, all across the state of 29 million people across two time zones, I don't think that the governor, the lieutenant governor, the attorney general, they're not going to be able to dictate to elections administrators in small communities exactly how they're going to do this, particularly when you have elderly populations that are worried about this, that aren't leaving their homes. I mean, I could tell you just northwest of Austin, in one of the Texas House districts, that's represented by a family doctor in the House, a Republican named J.D. Sheffield. He's in a runoff against a more conservative Republican. Those runoff elections happening on July 14th. And in talking to people who are involved with the campaign, and we talked about this a little bit last week, Arnie, that even with Republican voters, the Republican campaigns that are in runoffs right now are having to respect the fact that a lot of voters don't want people knocking on their doors. Usually, when you're running for office, that's how you win, is knock on the doors, have conversations with people, be in the community and all that, go to every community event. But those things aren't happening. You know, whether the governor wants to open up the state or not, the little old ladies, the little old men are still staying at home, keeping the doors shut. And so campaigns on the Republican side can't even communicate with voters that way. because people are still taking this quite seriously and are not going out, you have to question whether those people are really going to want to go to the voting booth on election day. It just doesn't add up. They're fighting their own people on this, is what I'm saying. People don't want to do this. They want the option.
All right, so answer one more question, then we're going to move on. And that is, so if fear of contracting COVID is not considered a disability for the purposes of getting an absentee ballot, then if you have an underlying health condition, you're not 65, you're 58, you're 62, you're 47, and you have diabetes, you have asthma, you've just had cancer and chemo.
Right. Who's going to sort that out?
Right. So is underlying health conditions considered a disability for the purposes of this?
That's not spelled out in the law. And again, the legal argument is not fear of COVID-19. It's lack of immunity to COVID-19, which we don't even know if anybody has immunity to COVID-19.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, they haven't even been able to tell us that this would be like other diseases where you would get the disease, then you would have antibodies that could fight it off, that you would have some immunity to it going forward. They don't even know that.
I know. It's just incredible. So let's talk about how to pay for COVID-19, the fight that we have had historically in Texas, just the way we've had this fight in New Hampshire, about property taxes. So connect COVID-19 to property taxes in Texas, because I'm about to connect COVID-19 and property taxes in New Hampshire. We have a very similar situation.
Is that right? When Governor Abbott went to the White House and he sat there with Dr. Birx and with President Trump, the White House press corps asked whether or not Texas was a model for other states as far as how we're handling COVID-19. And the answer from Dr. Birx, who is respected on both sides, Republicans and Democrats, you know, she's on the coronavirus task force, helping to head it up. And she had pointed to, number one, she said, every state is different. And then she said that there were two real bright spots in Texas. And those two places are Dallas and Houston. You may remember that Dallas and Houston were the local governments that were very aggressive about locking down the communities, telling businesses they needed to shut down. So, the governor got in a fight with the leadership in those areas about whether people should have to wear masks and all of that. Well, and I'll say this pretty quick because I know we're running short on time, but you remember last year we covered here on the show that the state government at war with local governments over property taxes. And of course, it's a real frustration for taxpayers. It's a real issue. There was no real fix for it, though. You may remember the lieutenant governor and the speaker of the House and the governor had acted like they won the Super Bowl, Arnie. They had fixed property taxes, and that's all you'd ever hear about it again. And of course, once again, people are starting to get some sense of what their property tax bill is going to be like. And of course, they didn't really fix anything. And in fact, in some places, the taxes will still go up, even though they were told that they were reformed. And the governor at one point even acted like property taxes were being cut in Texas, which they're not, full stop. The bill that was passed, the law in Texas, now says that a city and a county, that they can't grow their revenue by more than 3.5% in 1 year. That's the cap they put. If they're going to grow more than that, they have to ask voters to approve it. That's what was put in place. Now, the law that was passed has an exception in it that says that if there is a disaster declared, then those caps don't apply. And that goes back up to 8%, which is what it was before the new law was passed. That exception was asked for by counties on the Texas coast. I'm talking about Harris County, where Houston is, and Nueces County, where Corpus Christi is, Jefferson County, where Beaumont is, and it's because they have to deal with, forget the word hurricane, but that is correct. It is hurricanes. They're dealing with catastrophic events that are outside human control. Okay. Does that sound familiar? Now we have a declared disaster dealing with a catastrophic event that's outside of human control in all 254 counties. Now, in fairness to the governor and the lieutenant governor, they could not have foreseen that a year out, we would have had a disaster declared for the entire state of Texas. But the fact that they didn't foresee it does not change what the law says. The law says that those caps are lifted now, and I expect this to end up in court. And look, the law was tailored in such a way that whether there was a disaster declared by the President of the United States or the governor, then those caps would go away. And right now, we have these communities that are dealing with incredible costs because of COVID-19. There's a lot of fight over, the big fight over how to divvy up the federal dollars that flowed to Texas, $11.2 billion that was originally sent to Texas as part of the CARES Act. And they also need to make up the revenue shortfalls that they have. We've got local governments that are, you know, down 20, 30% in their budgets because sales taxes have gone away. Now they've got a property tax situation. And what they need, Arnie, is not to raise taxes on their constituents. That's the way that some have framed this up. What they need is flexibility to be able to run their community the way they see fit. They were the ones elected to do that in a state of 254 counties, 29 million people. There's a reason you have political subdivisions. You cannot make all the decisions in Austin for Houston, Lubbock, Dallas, El Paso, San Antonio, and everywhere else.
You as you're about to leave. So now you understand why there is such a demand for state and local government support in the next bailout bill.
That's right.
Absolutely crucial. In addition to which, not only are the local governments trying to figure out what to do when they have the revenues being cut, but now because where there's going to be increased pressure on bigger spaces for schools in order to return kids back to school, they're going to need extra space, they're going to need extra teachers, they're going to need to figure out how to do remote. All those things have an additional cost, Scott, an additional cost as revenues have shrunk. So we just need to add that to the equation. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report. He is the voice of Texas. He is the dean of the Austin Press Corps. If it is Friday, it must be Texas. Stick around for a little current cast. We'll be right back. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
Good fences make good water. On this current cast. Cows wading in a stream might make a pretty picture, but the reality is a lot less pleasant. Gene Kahn is a microbiologist with Stroud Research Center. He's been monitoring streams in the Delaware River watershed for bacteria that are present as a result of fecal contamination. And he's found high levels, especially in summer.
We try to understand why we have that high number of bacteria and how can we reduce those bacteria.
Kahn says possible causes include leaky septic systems and runoff from nearby farm fields. But wading cows also contribute by excreting waste directly in the water. So he says fencing livestock out of streams can help protect water quality. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We are at Part 2, and if it's Part 2 of Friday every other week, it is Bill Curry. Bill Curry was a former Democratic nominee for governor twice in the state of Connecticut. He was an advisor to Bill Clinton. He has written for Salon.com. He is one of the best, I think, progressive analysts in the country. I reached out to him this morning, we tape on Thursday for Friday, and I said, so what do you want to talk about? And I have to compliment Bill Curry, because I miss this, Bill. You said, let's talk about the Hungarian government and their 82-day dictatorship. And I'm like, huh? What are you talking about?
Counting.
So I'm like, I had no clue to what you were talking about. So I posted this on my personal Facebook page, and then I'm going to toss it to you because I am so grateful that, you know, while there is too much on our plate, you must have a bigger plate than me. That's all I have to say, because you were following stories I just would not have focused on. And I wrote the following, oh, and you can imagine the word I used. It begins with S and ends with T. And I wrote, I missed this, the EU's first dictatorship. Orban is a Trump favorite, and Steve Bannon is an Orban advisor. And let me just read the opening sentences from The Guardian. The Hungarian government plans to bring to an end controversial emergency legislation, which some critics describe as creating the EU's first dictatorship. Hungary's Justice Minister, Judit Varga, announced on Tuesday that she would submit legislation to Parliament imminently that would bring an end to the so-called state of danger on June 20. While in force, it has allowed the country's prime minister, Viktor Orban, to rule by decree and had no fixed cutoff date. Oh my God. And you said, we need to talk about what's happening in Germany. We need to talk about what's happening in Hungary, because there's another story going on. And the story isn't just about the racial divide. The story isn't just about the health inequities. The story isn't about what the sort of pandemic has exposed when it comes to this country to some extent. That what this pandemic has also exposed is that there is now a breaking of democratic institutions and democracy as we know it. And it's not just what Donald Trump is doing, but we're seeing it erupt all over the world.
Trump is the global poster boy for this. And he is the greatest cheerleader of fascist governments emerging across the world. Truly, not just to us, but I mean, around the world, he is without a doubt the most significant proponent of the assault on democracy. There's a war on democracy. Putin's a part of it. Orban's an example of it. It's going on everywhere. one of the things I say to many of my progressive friends is just because our democracy is so deeply flawed, there's no reason not to defend it and not to defend the ideal of democracy, which is at the very center of our own thinking. The thing about Hungary is, it's a story I've been following for a while. It's so appalling. And there are so many connections, financial and otherwise, the most well-known of which is Steve Bannon, the noted so-called nationalist populist advisor to Trump, who is very close to Orban and has been a great, great promoter of Orban. Trump had Orban in the White House over the objections even of John Bolton and, of course, of Fiona Hill and the reasonable staff, Bolton plus the reasonable staff. I want to make sure there's two different categories. Yeah. And he did it anyway, because that was just, that's what he wanted to promote. Absolute, there's no question about it. Few of us would hesitate to use the word fascist in describing Orban. He has destroyed Trump's big wet dream. He has destroyed the First Amendment and the free press. 90% of the Hungarian press is state-owned or owned by oligarchs aligned with Orban. Everyone, as here, again, we have what you might call the shadow syndrome of all of this. Because it's America and our own traditions are stronger, our democratic traditions are stronger than they are in almost any other country, Trump's latitude, Trump's field of action is constrained. He can't be Orban, but he keeps testing it every day. Yes. The war on the post office, the war on Jeff Bezos, the war on AT&T and CNN.
The war on Twitter.
On what?
On Twitter.
The current war on Twitter today, which is what had me thinking about it this morning.
Right.
This is exactly what Orban has been up to. He wants to issue an executive order. And as I pointed out in that email I sent you, issue an executive order and rule by decree are the same thing now. When Trump's issuing executive orders, he's ruling by decree. And by the way, they have not only financial backers in common and political advisors in common and a mutual and very public bromance, Orban and Trump, but the list of ways in which they govern alike is very long. And again, in this country, I know we're all sensitive to it, but this is a country of minority rule now. We live in a country of minority rule. It's one of the ways in which it's hard to describe what we have as an actual democracy. But Orban, like Hitler, if you don't mind my pointing it out, never won a majority in an election. He has a veto-proof two-thirds majority in the parliament, despite never getting 50% of the vote, because the gerrymandering is so criminal. It's so extreme. They've actually been able to do that. And again, that's happening here. Voter suppression, especially racial voter suppression, but all manner now of voter suppression, as the mail-in ballots controversy attests to. Again, the war in the free press, the war in the process. We are Hungary writ large. It's just like we're following the pandemic, where it hits one country first, and then it comes a couple of weeks later. We may be a year or so behind them, and we may never get there, I pray. Do not doubt for one second that this is where Trump is trying to take us, to despotic one-man rule. That is his oft-professed, he's told us this, as well as shown it. And so we should be more apt, as I've said before, to use the word fascist in describing this. It's what it is. But it's a war on truth and a war on democracy.
I mentioned Twitter because we now know that's the new fight du jour, and that he's going to somehow try to somehow control Facebook and Twitter because they have an agenda against him and his people. So I want to connect Orban to this story as well. Listen to this from The Guardian. A separate measure also included potential prison sentences for spreading false information. Although no cases have yet come to court under the decree, police have launched more than 100 investigations and in some cases have hauled citizens in for questioning over critical Facebook posts.
Yep.
The emergency law still has a month to go, and we also don't know which measures will remain in place after the state of danger is ended, says Political Capital, a think tank in Budapest. But I just want people to understand, we're seeing Trump with this fight now with Twitter and Facebook. Look what Orban did. Orban was having people arrested, investigated for controversial posts in Facebook. This was the precursor. Watch Orban, then watch Trump.
This is, by the way, These aren't criminal sanctions that Trump is proposing. They are civil sanctions. They are alike in that he's going to take these people to court. And right. Misinformation is Orban's and Trump's word for the truth. Okay. Yeah. Whenever they talk about misinformation, they mean telling the truth. And whether it's whistleblowers or newspapers or social media, this is a war on the truth. And again, it's an essential part of any totalitarian dictatorship, especially fascist. But it goes on night and day in before our very eyes. And I'll just lastly say about this. I've spent my whole life telling, especially my progressive allies, not to waste time on conspiracy theories. There's enough wrong with the world that we can see with our own eyes without having to ferret around for things that might or might not be true that we can never prove. If we could just fix the stuff we know is wrong, we'd live in a really wonderful place. I have to say, though, that for the first time in my life, here in my golden years, the idea that an election could be stolen, the idea that an autocrat is out to suppress and subvert democracy at every turn, we are living this nightmare right now, right now. There has to be a very studied and focused and public and vigorous argument made and analyses brought to people's attention. And we have to fight this every step of the way. There is no doubt in my mind that if Trump could find a way to stay in office having lost an election, he would. And you just can ask yourself of what you know about him. Every day he tries to push the boundary further of decency and truth, and every day he does. And we have no reason to think that there's any point at which these appetites of his would be self-limiting. Yeah. We have no reason. We don't know where his boundary is, but we know that in all the classical analyses of his psychological condition of malignant narcissism, the suggestion is very strong, the analysis is very strong, that there aren't any. That it verges into the completely sociopathic is, you know, again, you don't have to be a botanist to know the difference between a ragweed and a rose. You don't have to be a psychiatrist to know that this is a deeply, deeply mentally and emotionally impaired man who is the president of the United States. There are no obvious limits to what he would do, and there may be none at all.
So there's so many places. I need you for 3 hours, but I also posted something on Facebook when I was thinking about what happened to George Floyd in Minneapolis. I lived in the Twin Cities. I worked at the IDS building, you know, the building with Mary Tyler Moore throws her hat up in the air.
Yeah, you worked there.
There's literally a picture of me doing that.
EDD, I'm sure there is.
I'm sure. And I lived in an apartment on Loring Park. You're going to love it. I lived in an apartment on Loring Park.
Next door to Valerie Harbor.
It said, the advertisement for the apartment said, Mary Tyler Moore wants to live here. Okay, that was the I moved in and I sent my mother the classified that said Mary Tyler Moore wants to live here. And I wrote her and I said, and Rhoda moved in. Okay. So I have this connection to Minnesota. I did radio in Minnesota on the Hubbard stations. I went to school at St. Olaf. And I watched the story of George Floyd. And I suddenly wrote something on Facebook because it was all night long. It kept sort of banging in my head. And this is what I wrote. 2020, George Floyd, black, is dead for passing a counterfeit $20 bill. 2008, Wall Street executives, predominantly white, risky behavior caused $2 trillion in economic loss. No one went to jail. The reason I posted this is that there's a new New Yorker piece entitled, Is Capitalism Racist? There's so many ways to look at this George Floyd story on so many levels, but it is just shocking to see what happened with people even saying to the cops, don't do this. I don't know what I would have done. I've actually been in a situation where I've actually talked to a cop and said, stop, and literally taken their arm. I literally have. I mean, but of course I'm safe to do that. I'm white. I am safe to do that. I have permission to do that. I am white, you know, and this was a white cop in a white neighborhood. I don't know what it's like when you're watching a white cop and a black guy in, you know, it just, the whole thing was just so frightening to me. Again, what this pandemic has exposed is all the rot that we have known about forever. And we've been shoving it under the rug. Well, there's no rug anymore, Bill Curry. There's no rug. Democracy is about to look like it feels like it's being sacrificed. What we've done with the level of inequality is unbelievable. You would think, given all the stories, that cops would be at least more aware of their behavior. Not that they don't have a tendency on occasion to do this, but given that there are similar stories out there, that they would think that they could not murder someone for doing something so similar. I don't understand what happened to like the learning curve. I don't understand why police officers don't understand that they used to be called officers of the peace. They were to promote stability, not to actually encourage it. So I'm looking at all this, and again, between the pandemic and George Floyd and now Hungary, there is too much to comprehend. And I'm just hoping that it doesn't dissuade people from participating in November, but make them understand the incredible urgency of November.
I've spent a lot of the last few years urging progressives to be a little more like the socialists of the 1920s, who were constantly trying to organize the people into labor unions by getting them to translate their racial and tribal instincts into class instincts, and thereby to unite them. I always pick up on, in a sort of a bickering way, with a phrase like, is capitalism racist? No, but its consequences are racist so long as we have this society already set up as it is. And the problems with capitalism are different and deeper and affect everyone. But yes, any system that produces flagrant and persistent economic inequality is going to be racist in its impact. That's the deal that we live with and we have to recognize and we have to try to redress. I've asked people to imagine the Trump voters who weren't racist, who were simply desperate white working class people who'd lost their pensions and their equity in their homes and whose life expectancy was falling, whose suicide rates were up, whose children weren't going to go to college after all, who were facing retirement, dead flat broke, and nobody ever called their name. And the Democratic Party that had once been their tribune had become the party of its own donors. And I believe that much that we did created that backlash. The other side of that argument is that most of the motivation was racial. My response to which has always been, but how could you, then why didn't these people elect people like Trump all the time? Why did they leave now? And we need to have a politics that brings back the people who aren't just racially motivated. Watching the last justice, George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery, and just watching these stories that never, ever seem to cease is a reminder that you can't just do what I'm talking about, that you can't leave this behind. And I just want to point out one thing about it. It breaks my heart. I didn't know about the counterfeit bill part of it because for the first couple of days, I couldn't bring myself to finish the stories. It was just, it is too upsetting. It is too discouraging. When you and I were younger, we never dreamed we'd be here now. No. When we started out, we thought that we were going to end up in a much better place, that America was going to make a lot more progress. We just assumed we were on the road to someplace better. It might have a couple of detours, might have different levels, you know, different speeds, but we were going to get there. And one of the reasons so many of us suffer clinical depression right now, I think, looking out our window at the society, is that it's no longer clear where this story ends and how it ends. But the racial piece of it, that part of this injustice that is about race, it just has to be, as delicate as it is, it has to be the center of the discussion. And one of my thoughts about this is just that it has to be the center of discussion among progressives. And I'm specifically thinking about the labor movement. The role of the police unions in defending these murders is so dispiriting. It is so disappointing. I want to say on behalf of all of my Irish brethren, and I was born into a family believed if you didn't vote Democratic, you couldn't be buried in the Catholic Church. I know this culture. It is my own. Yeah. And I was watching some of the de Blasio of the firings, the shots taken of those police in New York and the heads of the unions. Once again, the New York, like Minneapolis, is not Trump country. Minneapolis, where Floyd was murdered. Neither one of those cities is Trump country, but their unions are Trump country. And my Irish brethren, the two great critics of de Blasio from the police unions, are named Mullins and Lynch, and I urged them to think of the history of our people, of all people who've come here seeking a better life, and all people who've suffered oppression, the police unions throwing in their lot with a fascist, which again is what Trump is. It's the worst possible signal. I talked before about Trump only going so far to the civil courts, not the criminal courts, on the First Amendment. When the police are actively politically involved as apologists for racist murders and in support of a fascist president, it is chilling to the bone. And I live in Farmington, Connecticut. We have a wonderful police department that I'm thrilled, I'm grateful to them for my safety each day. I grew up in the city of Hartford, somewhat more of a mixed record there, but I love those people and I love what they did. But I also know that there are issues of both racism and corruption in American police departments. And I expect our labor movement to begin now to be a part of the solution.
As you're talking about the police union and sort of at its core that it has this supporting relationship with Trump is just mind blowing. But then it reinforces what just happened in Minneapolis. But I'm also thinking about the labor unions that were so angry at the Democrats who are talking about Medicare for all because they had negotiated these great benefit packages for their union members. And now those great benefit packages don't exist. Why? Because those jobs don't exist. And so they focused on the moment and maybe where their power comes from and what they were able to negotiate. But in the end, that's not their job. Their job is to protect workers and to recognize that the biggest complaint I also used to hear from labor unions was they hated the healthcare negotiation because what they were doing is they were giving up compensation in order to make sure they continued to have the health benefit. So you didn't see a raise, but you basically still got your health insurance. Well, guess what? Your mortgage payments went up. Your property taxes went up. Your food bill went up. But it's okay. You can still go to a doctor when you're sick because I was able to negotiate a health insurance plan. It sucked all around and they know it and they knew it. And now with the pandemic, with so many people, you know, either unemployed or trying to collect an unemployment check or not knowing how to pay COBRA, I'm looking at them going, you still like what you negotiated, but you know what you needed? A freaking job. And they know that because I've heard the lament from them, but that lament disappeared all of a sudden. And that fed right into Donald Trump's lines.
More than 60 years ago, Walter Reuther wrote a letter to the president of General Motors saying that he didn't want healthcare benefits for auto workers. He wanted General Motors to join him in lobbying for a national healthcare plan. And he wrote very patiently, what you don't seem to understand is that you can't afford what you're offering us. That in the end, this will be too great an economic burden for you to sustain. Walter Reuther, as in so many issues, was so right. Again, I don't want to be blaming the victims here. The labor unions have been the victims of big donor politics and the Democratic Party and of globalization and of all kinds of other forces and the weakening of the rule of law, especially in labor relations. But there is a need for a broader and bolder leadership here as well. And again, I agree with what you said about the healthcare stuff. I strongly agree. I have strong feelings about what's happening in the police unions. I know these are difficult.
You know what? It's out of love. But it's out of love. You're not saying this to be critical. You're saying this in order to want to save them. We need a police force that can be developed around trust. What's happening with this sort of racism streak in support of Trump is eroding them. It is destroying them.
My point is not that all police officers are racist. Far from it. My point is, and I understand when they get defensive, when the critique of them seems to be cast too broad a net. I get it. But they have to. They have to begin to stand up and root out racism where they find it and take the kinds of actions, training, citizen oversight, other safeguards that ensure that we can have the kind of police enforcement that we all of us as citizens deserve. This is heartbreaking.
I need to let you go. And I want to remind everyone, we need a police force that we can trust. I don't want to have to sit there and decide, oh my God, is this one of those that, you know, has a racist streak? Is this not? There's too much opportunity here to reevaluate. It can be better. but you have to do something to make it better. It just doesn't happen. Bill Curry, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. Bill Curry joins us every other Friday on Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think, let your mind go, let yourself be free. Let's go back, let's go way on the way back when. I didn't even know you couldn't have been too much more than 10.